There's a wonderful Australian poem I recommend to your attention in the Oxford Book of Australian Verse about the Duke of Buccleuch. It comes from around the early 20th century. It's a ballad about somebody was importing a sire. Some cattleman was importing a great sire called the Duke of Buccleuch, and some chap sent out a cable to the effect that the Duke of Buccleuch would be arriving in Sydney on a certain date, and the word flashed round the posh side of Sydney at the time, and they all turned up to greet this great English or Scottish nobleman. You know, the governor himself was there, and the railway commissioner with a gold pass specially printed, specially struck for the Duke of Buccleuch to travel anywhere on the railway. And the idlers and ne'er-do-wells of the town were delighted when the Duke of Buccleuch was slung on shore and turned out to be a bull rather than a man. It was a sire. Came out and was it stud duty to do? Just like a regular Duke of Buccleuch.
And that rhymes too.
And all the society of Sydney fled, you know, including all the mothers who brought their daughters in case the Duke wasn't wed, you know. I recommend it to your attention.
Yeah, I was going to actually ask you about the collection. Is it Helen Dafter, the collection of early Australian poets?
Oh, yeah.
That you've just been putting together. I thought it would be interesting to hear about a bit about these poets.
Yeah, well, I thought that they were the four best English language poets at the beginnings of Australian poetry, which I've read most of. You know, Australian poetry is only about less than 200 years old, and you can read it all still. It's not insurmountable, but the earliest one that I found of high quality was Frank the Poet McNamara. He's got a marvellous poem. He's got several marvellous poems. He's sort of in the Irish tradition with a bit of Burns as well, you know. He wrote this poem about a visit to hell. It's called A Convict's Tour to Hell, in which he dies, goes down past purgatory, finds only the popes in there who invented the place, and turns up at the devil's door, and the devil says, no, Frank, no, we don't touch convicts. I hate the poor. I never let them in here. Your place is heaven, but since you've got time to spare now, I'd take you on a conducted tour. So they go through the place, and they meet all the commandants and floggers and Captain Cook, who discovered Australia in the first place, and the man who invented jails and all sorts of enemies of humankind of this one. And it's not a very gloating poem. It's really quite lightly done. But he does gloat a little bit over some of these fellows, you know, suffering their deserts down there. And
he had experienced a lot of this suffering.
Oh, he mentions all the people he'd been oppressed by under the convict system, you know, the various stockades and jails that he'd been kept in, and the fellows who'd flogged him and so on. He was sentenced to, 14 years, if I remember rightly. No, 7 years for stealing a plaid, but really he was sent because he was a white boy. People who were in rebellion against paying taxes to the Church of Ireland, the Anglican Church. And although he may have been an Anglican himself, they were never quite sure whether he was Catholic or what. But and there's a line of McNamara bards from County Clare he may have been related to in Irish. Seems to have known Irish, but because some of his poems have that sort of flavour about them. But anyhow, this poem, he visits all these chaps and points out to them the error of their ways and the justice of where they are, and then he goes on. The devil wishes him a cheery farewell, and he goes up to heaven, and St. Peter is a bit doubtful about him and says, "Who do you know in heaven?" And he started naming various fellows who've been hanged and shot by the by the guards and things like that. And Jesus turns up and says, no, Peter, let him in now. We've been waiting for Frank. Job, go and fetch a robe for Frank. And somebody else, he set off to bring the fatted calf. They're going to have a great party to welcome Frank to heaven. At that point he woke up. It's a splendid poem. And what's nice about it is that it's not sort of heavily sadistic. It's not having his revenge. It's just doing it very lightly.
This is a description of hell. What was this?
Oh, it was a burning place. It was people were shackled to iron posts in the fire, and people were being tormented by demons. And there was one fellow, Captain Morris, said, if I remember rightly, had dreadful worms coming out of his mouth as he spoke. And yeah, it was the full Dantean special, you know. Anyway, the rest of the book, the other three are a woman called Mary Gilmore, who was born in 1865 and lived to 1962. And she wrote a terribly variable quality. I mean, a lot of her poetry is rubbish, but the best of it's very good. And I sieved through it carefully. Where she went wrong, she wrote a lot of things in dialect. She wrote in Irish, sort of stage Irish and stage Scots, and she was never any good in those, but some of her poems in straight English were very good indeed, and I made a good selection of them.
Yeah, what was her background?
Her father was an Ulsterman. He seems to have been close friends with the Aborigines of the Wiradjuri tribe down in southwestern New South Wales, and she was born in, I don't know if she was born in Goulburn, but she grew up at Wagga, and the trouble is Mary was given to stretch in the truth here and there, so it was a bit hard to tell exactly what she'd done. For example, she's got a famous poem about the hanging of various Chinamen at a place called the Lambing Flat. 14 Chinamen all hanging in a row, you know, after a riot, an anti-Chinese riot. There's a couple of holes in this story. A, there were no Chinese hanged at Lambing Flat, and B, it all happened 4 years before she was born, but she claimed to have seen it from the family buggy as they drove by. Yeah. And so you're never quite sure with Mary, but she was great friends with...
Maybe she lied about her age, though.
About what?
Maybe she lied about her age. Well, you say it's 4 years before she was born, but maybe she lied about her age.
Yeah.
Rather than about the...
Well, if that's true, then she lived to be well into her 110s.
All right.
Anyway, she wrote some good poems, and she's worth a read. And there's a wonderful woman in there that people don't know much about, called Lesbia Harford, who... Lesbia by name and Lesbia by nature. She was Lesbia Keogh, but she married a fellow called Harford late in her short life. And she wrote about her male and female lovers with no inhibitions whatsoever. And this is in the early part of the 20th century, where other people were pussyfooting all over the place, you know. And nobody took it against her. She was a devout socialist of that period, and was sort of YWW socialist. And she didn't make the move on into the Communist Party. She wasn't of that sort, you know. And she's well worth reading. I think she's comparable with Emily Dickinson. And and the fourth one is John Shaw Neilson, who was a strange bloke who had no formal education much and couldn't read after about the age of 25, 30. His eyes were so bad. And he worked as a labourer, you know, very hard-working jobs like quarryman and... fencing contractor and all that, and he wrote these very delicate ethereal poems, some of which are a bit over fairy, you know, but the best of them are really hauntingly good. So they're the four, and I wanted to present them to the British reading audience because they'd never seen them until recently. We had this thing, the British Empire mindset, you know, nothing good can come out of the colonies, and double plus, that is double plus true for Australia, which everybody knows is a place of convicts and barbarism. And I produced a book 10 years earlier which showed them some poets of the generation before me. It's a book called Five Fathers, and that's a hell of a good book, and that sold quite well. The English never... I think there was only ever 1.5 reviews of it in Britain, and one of them was by Clive James. but they
is that the half or the full one?
It was very literal.
Yeah.
But it sold well. It sold quite well. They're prepared to read it, but not to concede the point. I don't think there's been any reviews of Helen after. It seems to sit.
Have you got any sort of sense of how you would characterise Australian poetry?
I'm doing a retrieval. I'm trying to find the best of it and present it, to audiences that won't have seen it before. What was sad to me was that only in my generation did Australian poets start to get heard of outside of Australia. And I thought, I want to reach back and show people, these poets who were deprived of their natural wider audience by the old prejudices. And I think that's what I've had a bit of an effect in doing, although I think the effect will be greater as time goes on, because the old British Empire mindset still exists in name publishing. What I found out the hard way is that you have to publish here and you have to publish in America if you're going to have distribution in those countries. You can't publish in Australia and expect your book to be ordered outside of Australia.
Well, actually, it's not very different in Scotland.
Yeah.
I noticed something on your website. You were saying that poetry is the sort of canary, of the publishing world, and this problem of shops not taking backlists and so forth. Got a very similar situation here.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
It's getting worse.
Doesn't surprise me. You just live closer to the old Imperial Theatre.
Well, that's right. I mean, they've gone down from the Publishers Association to try and, accept that Scotland's a country and that Scottish publishers' stuff should be in the shops, but they won't. They'll do central buying. And
there are a couple of impassable rules. One is that if you publish in Australia, no British bookshop is going to order you. You have no prestige, and so I had to get out of there. But I was just trying to find ways to get friends of mine out of there, including dead friends of mine. And poets are deserving. Hasn't happened yet, but at least I've done what I could in that direction.
There's the thing you also say about, Aboriginal, the Aboriginal sort of society, that poetry is a sort of essential part of all sorts of stuff, and it's often sung. And I wondered if you ever sung your poems.
I don't.
You don't?
I have heard it done. Not very often. I heard it done very well once in Melbourne by a Hungarian band, of all things, a gypsy band. Heard a fellow do it in India the other day. I was travelling there reading, and a bloke stood up at the end of the reading in Kochi in Kerala and said, "Mr. Murray, I have no question," he said, "but while you were reading, I translated your poem, The Meaning of Existence, into Malayalam," that being the local language, and he proceeded to sing it. Sounds bloody marvellous to me. Everybody else there spoke the language. They seemed to like it no end. They liked it a lot better in his version than in mine. Because Indians do sing poetry, and I thought that's the way into the Indian market. It's not through books; it's through poems being sung. And of course, not all poems will sing. Some poems just are not built for it. But so there's a lot I don't know about that. I'm not very musical, and I only do music in words. But other people might know things that I don't in that regard.
What sort of questions did you get asked in India? Did you get asked any that surprised you?
I can't remember. They were the usual ones, mostly. Some about your influences, etc. The ones they learn in university or school.
I was quite interested.
I said my influences were largely lack of money and a fellow called Anthologus who makes anthologies.
I was interested to know about your tool shed, actually.
Mummy?
Tool shed. No, I wondered. I expect you have one.
Not really. I'm very lazy. I don't do work of that sort much. I do a bit of gardening.
Because it's the thing that was striking me was the way you describe tools and sort of working implements in your poems.
Oh yeah, I was always famous for being not afraid of work. I'd sit there and watch it all day, and I'll watch other people do it. Don't do much with myself. I know how to do a lot of things, but I can't be bothered doing them. I'd rather have somebody somebody else who does that do it, because they'll do it better and they deserve the wages. You know, I always say I have a devoutly union bias which says never take work off a qualified worker.
But there is something. I mean, do you literally like watching? I like watching people, if I ever get the chance.
Yeah.
Who really, really know what they're doing.
It's great fun. Yeah. And hell of a lot of them don't, of course, but don't work terribly well. But it's good. It's not bad working as somebody's assistant too.
Yeah.
And you get some fella in to clear up the garden and cut trees down and drag them away and things. You say, right, you're the boss. I'm the boy, and help them. And, of course, that's a bit of a con, because you're both the boss, really. He knows what the work and you know where you want things put. So you're both contributing to it. What was the last really good Scottish book I read? I'm trying to think. Probably somebody's book of verse, I would think. Whose book of verse? Sawley's. Yeah, I read all of they gave me all of Sawley's books when I was up at Saul Moore Austick. And I read a lot of the Gaelic stuff in translation. Interesting, most interesting. My favourite Scottish book of all time is a thing called The Private Memoirs and Confessions of
Justified
Sinner. That is the goods. It really is.
That's James Hogg, isn't it?
That is the goods, and it should be filmed. Because it still could be. I mean, you could find the locations in Edinburgh that he describes. You'd have to do it on a Sunday morning, perhaps, but...
They have tried it, I think.
Have they?
Jenny, haven't they? A number of times. I think that a couple of screenplays at least have been knocked together, you know, on that. And it just has never come to fruition. I mean, I don't know
it's a genuinely terrifying book, it really is.
Yeah.
I was born into the Freekirk tradition, and so it speaks to me a little bit more than to some others. And,
well, did your tradition have anything about that sort of the elect or anything?
It was fading by the time I arrived, but the echo of it was still around. I was telling a story about my Freekirk minister cousin just this morning. He's a good fellow. We've known each other since childhood. Name of Ray Murray. He studied up here on the mound, you know. And last time I saw him, last time I stayed with him, up in Grafton in New South Wales, we had breakfast and subject of poetry came up. And he said, yes, St. Paul says in his epistle to, I've forgotten exactly who, it might have been the Philippians, we are God's poems. I said, Ray, I've read the Bible, I've never read that. And he said, but you made the mistake of reading it in English. In Greek, I said, oh, right, poemata, things made in Greek. That's where the word does come from, poemata, I created things. I said, when I chewed that one over, I said, well, I'm very grateful to your reverence for this piece of information. He was quite pleased with himself. But he's a good lad. But when I was a kid, I didn't like the Freekirk sort of spirit. And I slithered away from it. And then Mum died and there was no more going to church. And I ended up Catholic. My father was so horrified that he never mentioned it. For 40 years, he never mentioned this dreadful backsliding on the part of his son. My German translator, I was telling her one day, I said, yeah, the old man never mentioned it. She said, he mightn't have mentioned it to you, but he mentioned it to me. I'll be damned, I said. What did he say? When? She said, when I was staying at your place. She said, you went off to Mass with Valerie, and he said to me, I'll never bloody know why he turned Catholic. I said, he should have asked me. He would never make that step.
But what was the appeal of the Catholic Church?
Oh, it was the Eucharist, the idea of the theology of the Eucharist. You know, the idea that something, a person can be bread, wine, and a bloke all at once. the sheer defiance of rationalism.
Well, it is a sort of defiance of rationalism in a sense, but I often think that once you enter it, it's like this incredibly well, you know, once you go through the door of it, then it's got a sort of internal logic somehow, but it's going through that door that would be the difficult.
It's a poetic logic.
A poetic logic.
Yeah.
What do you mean by poetic logic in that respect?
It's equally dream. It's as much dream as it is reason that stands to both. Nothing that stands only to reason is true, I don't think. But it's a satisfying dream as well, and satisfies the body and the dreaming mind and the rational mind all at once. And I don't trust anything that doesn't. Anything that's not poetical reasoning, I don't trust.
I'm not very clear that there is any sort of such thing, really, as reason, or as something that's sort of clearly rational. The things that are promoted as being so,
yes,
and promoted as superior to that.
It's rhetoric.
It is rhetoric, yeah.
They are said to be rational and so on, and people pride themselves, and all they're really boasting about is mutilating the processes of thought. That's what I got by stepping over that, either that dimension, or,
I would have thought that if people did actually perceive themselves as dreamers rather than creatures of reason, then
your reason's
life
enough.
Might be rather different.
Yeah, one of my favourite thinkers, she only came out with a great thought on the morning they shot her, was Edith Cavell, the English nurse. She said, "I've come to see that patriotism is not enough." And I thought, yeah, there's a lot of things in this world that are not enough. You know? Yeah. Reason is another one. Reason is not enough. Yeah, same sort of line of thought.
You've got a new book of poems that's already out in Australia, isn't it, and coming out here?
Yeah, it's called White Plain Houses. It's a kind of a mixed grill of various kinds of poems. You know, it doesn't have a direction. It's just this poem and that poem and another poem.
What's by a clean house?
Huh?
What's a by a clean house?
House with a veranda on it. It looks like an aeroplane with stubby wings.
Is that what it is? Yeah. I couldn't work out what that meant.
You don't see many verandas in this part of the world, but I grew up with them. They're still common at home. So I call it that. The term comes up in one of the poems.
Did you used to sleep on the veranda?
Yeah. That's an older poem. It's called The Sleep Out. We used to call them sleep outs because you had a partly screened-in veranda that... I used to watch the stars over my toes. I'd look down the foot of the bed and straight up to the stars.
It's my favourite poem of yours.
Is it?
Oh, absolutely. It's just so dreamlike. I think you captured the essence of what you were talking about earlier, and that's...
Yeah, it's a dreamy poem, all right.
Yes, the end, it's just breathtaking, I think. It's got everything I would ever want of any poems.
Yeah. That's where I used the term the daylight.
The daylight moon, yes.
Which is my symbol for poetry.
The daylight moon.
It belongs to the realm of night and sleep, and yet it's visible in the day. Aborigines are good on the moon. They've got lots of good moon legends. The moon man is a fat man. And he's fond of the evening star, who's a beautiful girl, and she won't look at him. I mean, he's just a fat fella. And so he goes out in the bush and he makes a woman calling magic and has an effect on her. And they marry and produce a little girl called Morning Star. And then there's never been any death amongst humans at this stage. They kill animals, but they themselves are not subject to death. And he's up in a tree cutting honey out of a branch, you know, out of a wild bee's hive up there. And the branch breaks off and falls on his daughter and kills her. And this is the first time a human's died. And the tribe are horrified. And they take after him with spears. And he runs off down the river and throws himself in. And they're slinging spears at him, and a few of them hit him. And he's floating down in his blood, you know, and drags himself out the grass, and the rushes and so on lean over the river to give him a purchase to climb out. And he drags himself out of the water, and by that stage they catch up with him and they're going to finish him off. And he floats off into the sky, and he says, to them as he rises. He said, I'm going to go and live in the sky now. And and my wife and daughter are going to come up and live with me. And you'll see me every month. I'll become old and I'll bend over and I'll be an old bent man, and then I'll die, disappear. Then I'll come back to life. I'll be a baby lying in a cradle, and I'll fatten up and grow up, and you'll be as you used to know me. And this will happen every month, forever. But you, when you die, you'll stay dead. That was the coming of death.
In what you said there, you used a sort of form of speech that interested me. You said that's my symbol for poetry, and I'm wondering, you know, do you create kind of symbols for various
that
things?
That one was that one came out of the left field. You know, that came out of sort of the dream side of the mind. I realised, yeah, took a while to realise. Oh yeah, I've made a symbol for poetry there.
Yeah.
Another time I was inventing symbols, I had it as the sun and moon together in the same thought, same speech balloon.
It's funny how symbols can be quite potent things, can't they? I mean, they
yes.
actually act as a sort of a talisman or a kind of shorthand trigger to,
yes.
to some sort of stream of
Yeah, I was always interested in symbols and heraldry and that sort of thing. When I'm over here, of course, there's not much heraldry in Australia, there never was. They don't do it very well, except with very rare exceptions. But over here, I wander about and see various heraldic symbols, and that wonderful kind of shorthand. I mean, they're often shorthand about boasting, you know, but they've got good ways of saying things.
Yeah. Well, I think that's
great.
That's good enough. That's wonderful. Thanks a lot, Les.
Good enough.
Thank you.